First Amendment auditors, their rights, your rights, and everything in between.
And here we go. Be sure to visit soundmind.app, peachjar.com, and nicholsstrategies.com. Advocating for public education, sharing our stories, and celebrating our schools, students, and staff. From crisis communications to media relations, social media, and everything in between, we're here to give you the best strategies, tools, and techniques to help you help others. Welcome to the School PR Podcast, brought to you by Peach Jar, Sound Mind, and Nichols Strategies. Here's your hosts, Matthew Jennings and Ryan Ferran.
All right, welcome back to the School PR Podcast. Good news today. Great news today. We kicked Matthew out. He's done with him. We're upgrading our co-host, and we're happy to have Ian Hannigan with us. Ian, good afternoon, sir. Thanks for filling in. We appreciate it.
I have some big shoes to fill today.
They're not that big. They're like size 4, maybe 4.5. You're good. Great to have you here. No, we do miss Matthew. Love Matthew, but he couldn't be here. So I called the man in the bullpen, and we got a righty coming out of the bullpen. So we're happy to have you, Ian. And our guest today, great topic. We saw Harold at CalSPRA. Did a great session there at CalSPRA about First Amendment auditors and kind of the rights and the laws and what people should know. And it was a highly attended session and rave reviews. And it's a topic that a lot of California schools throughout the state are dealing with and the nation. And there's some things that I definitely learned from the session, and I knew our audience would greatly appreciate it. And Harold, thanks so much for coming on. Harold Freeman is with Lozano & Smith law firm. And so Harold, appreciate you coming on today, making time.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So I guess we'll dive into this issue, give people kind of a surface level of what's happening with the First Amendment auditors and school districts and probably even other government agencies, and kind of what this trend has been looking like the past couple of years and how some school districts, kind of the issues they're facing with this.
Yeah, happy to dive in on that. And I'm actually greatly appreciative that you're doing this, because I feel a little like Paul Revere, where, you know, the British are coming, and somebody needs to ride around and alert people that this is coming their way. So if folks listening have not dealt with First Amendment auditors yet, they probably will. This is a nationwide trend, certainly a statewide trend. And in short, what a First Amendment auditor is somebody who comes often to your district office, your maintenance yard, sometimes even your school sites, to quote unquote audit whether you are following the First Amendment by allowing them onto public grounds. So they basically come barging in. Frequently, they have a hat pulled low, they have sunglasses on, they won't identify themselves. They sometimes come in a little hot, you know, where it's a little demanding. They often get more demanding as things progress, and they will always have a camera with them. So they're taping you on their phone. And really, there's two different ways to look at it. One is they are American-loving patriots who are coming on to ensure that public space is paid for by taxpayer dollars or accessible to the public. I haven't seen a lot that fit in that category. The other alternative is they are trying to get a rise out of whoever they are confronting when they come to the district office, so they can get some nice juicy video that they can put out on YouTube and monetize this. And that's not hypothetical. You know, we've looked into some of the First Amendment auditors who've shown up and who've done this, and we've seen their YouTube sites. We know that they're doing this to monetize it. And it's not just for school districts. They're showing up. A lot of police departments are getting this. So ironically, a lot of school districts think, well, if this happens, we'll call the police. Well, the police are dealing with it themselves. So it's more complicated than that, and other public facilities as well.
Harold, let me ask you. So you've looked into these, just to give people who are listening an idea, how much traction do these videos get in terms of views and overall engagement? And, you know, how much can somebody be monetizing something like this?
You know, it's significant. So some of the YouTube channels we've seen, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of hits. And, you know, I don't know what they get per hit, but they get something. And some of them are as crass as on the end of their YouTube, they'll just say, you know, tune in again because it gets me more money. Some are a little less direct than that. But it's significant hits. And we know from some incidents that have happened where the school district may have gotten into more of a confrontational mode with these folks. And so it gets even juicier video. When those videos have gone out, we've had calls for recall of the board. We've had demands coming from out of state to fire the superintendent, to fire the public information officer, fire the receptionist. Sometimes hundreds of those come in, sometimes thousands of those come in. So this is not a, you know, a small little isolated incident that happens. And then on top of that, the other thing you have to think about, some of these people are coming on are First Amendment auditors, and that's sort of the way we lump them. Sometimes it's just a parent who also has taken out their camera and is coming in and demanding to see the superintendent, demanding to walk through your district office or your maintenance yard, getting into people's spaces. We had one not terribly long ago. It was an after-school event where somebody in the community showed up with a camera and was putting the camera in teachers' faces and students' faces. And so the same law applies when we think about this, whether it's this quote-unquote First Amendment auditor or it's just the irate parent who's showing up. And one of the hardest things I think for school districts is this very simple factor that when somebody shows up with a hat pulled low and sunglasses on, and during COVID, sometimes it was with a mask on, they won't give their name. You know, they got the camera in one hand and they have their hand in their other pocket. Are we worrying about a threat? Are we concerned that this person may actually be violent? You know, we've seen incidents in the country where people have shown up at school board meetings with guns. And then one famous incident actually took a shot at some school board members. So, you know, you have to balance all of these different components. So when we just say First Amendment auditor, we're catching this whole broad spectrum of who's allowed on a district office, what's the context when they're allowed, what are the limitations that you can impose?
Yeah, it's a really good point because it's definitely a trend throughout, and even you see now videos being posted with police stops. If somebody gets a traffic stop, they're videotaping it. So whether they're doing it like a First Amendment cause or they're just doing it because they've been enabled through the years, they're going to show up to your school board meeting with a camera or whatever. It, you know, you're right. They're all kind of lumped in, but there are a lot of the laws are very similar, no matter what their reason or cause is. I feel like it's applicable, and we're definitely seeing more and more of this.
Yeah, and you know, I think at a certain point you see engagement numbers, like you were just saying, Harold, that really rival what you might get in terms of coverage on TV. And so how, you know, I guess that leads into the question of what should districts be doing? How should their staff be prepared to handle this?
That's a very good question. And, you know, I gave a keynote speech through another organization, I guess it was last year, where I was doing the Paul Revere again, where I was sort of saying this is coming. And in their case, I shared this story, which is that I work with one small school district. Their district office is wide open. There's no barriers to stop anybody from going wherever they want. And their entire method of security is there is a semi-retired octogenarian receptionist who sits at her desk and asks you who you're there to see. And the moment we had this incident happen at that school district, that poor person almost had a heart attack. She had no plan. She had no idea what to do. The way that her little reception desk is laid out, she couldn't get past the person even to go into another office to ask for assistance. And so, you know, what I was talking about is you have to treat this almost like fire drills, is always the theme that I use, where you'll do exercises where, you know, somebody sounds the alarm and everybody has to go to their place of security and you follow the person in the yellow vest and all those good things. We don't do any of that at district offices, at maintenance yards, at other sites. We may do it at school sites, but at the administrative offices, we tend not to. And the administrative offices tend not to be fenced off or have more security in place the way a school site does. So the first thing we always recommend is have a plan. Even before we get to what does the law say, what are you going to do if X happens? If somebody appears potentially violent, you know, does that receptionist or the person who's the first person confronting the individual who's coming on, do they have a way of reaching out to someone else for assistance? Do they have a door that they can walk behind to protect themselves? Is there an easy way for somebody to call the police? And in the vast majority of school districts I work with, and I work with hundreds, I think about this when I walk in their district office, because I immediately see they're not set up that way. Some are, and because of these First Amendment auditors, more are moving in that direction. So step one is just having a plan. Step two, which is also really critical, is understanding a little bit about the law in this area, because there's this assumption that school districts make, well, at district office, we have student information, we have employee information. Clearly, it's not a public space. People can't just wander through it filming. But that's not exactly right, because California law, a lot of which resides in the penal code, and it's in the penal code because it's when you're doing something that is potentially a criminal act, talk about notions of trespassing. They talk about notions for public property. Is somebody coming on and causing an actual disruption? Are they making an actual threat? Well, if it's a public space and it's not labeled as anything other than a public space, very hard to get the police to treat it as trespassing when one of these people show up. And are they causing a disruption? Simply by standing there and filming, is that enough to be disruptive? And there's some point where I'm thinking of one where the First Amendment auditor just pushed on past the receptionist and started walking into individual administrators' offices and filming and doing close-up pictures of the people's families on their desk and clearly, again, trying to get a rise out of them. So understanding at that point, if you call the police, which is what a lot of school districts do, the police may show up and say, well, where does it say that this isn't public space? How do I know that this is trespass? So the second step beyond just having a general plan is really thinking about having policies in place and putting up appropriate labeling so that the public and the police alike know this is the public part and this is the non-public part. So you might have
specifically of signage.
Yeah, definitely signage, sometimes physical barriers, you know, adding a door, adding a plexiglass to, you know, sort of demark where an area goes. We work with one school district where the public area is tiled and the private area is carpeted. And they've added signage to make clear once you're on the carpeted portion, or at least they're trying to, you've left the public area. And the big distinction is that, you know, for that district office in particular, once you're in the carpeted area, there's people's desks with personnel information and student information and their own personal information that's sitting out there. When you're up in the tiled area, the lobby area, there's really nothing that's going to be non-public. And that district's actually looking at putting up some physical barriers and not just leaving it at that point.
So, you know, I have a question about, you know, in many states, you need two-party consent to record phone conversations. From a legal standpoint, why does a standard like this not apply to filming staff?
Yeah, well, it does and it doesn't apply. So California has the same law. We call it two-party consent. Really what it is a wiretapping law. You're not allowed to record somebody else with audio. Video you can. But with audio, you're not allowed to without that person's consent. But the big unless is it's in a public setting where there's no expectation of privacy. So going back to an after-school event where there were parents and kids and everybody milling around, it would be really hard to argue that somebody has a reasonable expectation of privacy when they're out there in the open communicating with other members of the public. So in a district office setting, if somebody walks in and just starts filming, you always, as an employee, could say, I don't give you my consent to have my audio recorded. And there's a little bit of a difference in saying my video, because again, the law is looser on video, but I don't consent for you to record me on audio. And the First Amendment auditor may say, well, you're in a public space, so you're not entitled to that. You don't have that protection. I'm not recording your phone call. I'm not recording you, you know, in the bathroom. I'm recording you here in the hallway of a public building. And so you can try that I don't give my consent, but it may not necessarily be enough. And if you go to the police and you say they were unlawfully recording me with audio and the police come and look and see it was a hallway, it was the front lobby of a district office, they're not going to treat that as an unlawful moment.
And you can't, so if a school district wanted to declare everything a non-public space, they couldn't do that because of the nature of public funding and the nature of a district office, right? You have to have some public space in a district office, I would imagine.
You know, it's a little bit of an unsettled legal issue as to whether you could just label everything as, you know, inaccessible to the public. I think if you try that, you're potentially going to be challenged. And there's these concepts under the First Amendment, since the First Amendment auditors are talking about that particular part of the Constitution. There's this concept in both federal and state law that you have some spaces that are designated public forums. You have some spaces that are traditional public forums. It's never been announced that the public's allowed there, but they've always been allowed there. And if you have a space that falls under one of those settings, it's a little bit harder to suddenly just say, we're closing it all off. So typically for a district office, you know, the public is generally going to be allowed in the lobby. You have family members who are coming in to get information. Those are all members of the public. You haven't closed it off. And you know, some districts try to put up signage that say, you know, no unauthorized personnel admitted past this point, which I think is a good start. But if you put that up on the front door of a public building, especially a lot of these district offices is where you have public board meetings and other things that are both traditional and designated public forums, it's really hard to shut it down.
So just to recap, I always want to say, you know, for those who are just joining us, but I don't think people join in the middle of your podcast, right, Ryan?
Sometimes. You never know. You never know.
But just to recap, so one is just the overall having a plan, being prepared. Two is labeling spaces and signage. But I'm curious, what are some examples that you've seen, good or bad, that really illustrate how to handle these situations?
Well, I will conglomerate some good into a one, say, hypothetical, and I'll conglomerate some bad into a hypothetical. So good is the following is in place. They have signage up. Somebody comes into the building, and in addition to the signage, they have board policy and administrative regulations that clearly authorize the superintendent or others to put up these signs, because the police may actually ask if they're called. Well, gosh, you have these signs up. Who authorized them? Where is it in your policy? Sometimes they'll say in your ordinance, because they don't understand how school districts work. But in the best examples, they have policy in place. Even better, they've already reached out to the local police department to talk about at what point can we call you and at what point will you be willing to remove somebody. Now, that's easier in a small district, in a small town where the police chief knows everybody. And it's harder in a giant urban setting, but it's certainly worth at least checking and seeing if the police will do a walkthrough and look at your signage and do all of that. But the main thing that designates when people are doing well is when they stay calm. When one of these First Amendment auditors comes in and they're just trying to get people riled up, if you can be respectful and you can be calm, it makes for terrifically boring video. It makes it less likely the video gets posted. And you really apply the standard of the law, which is this person causing a disruption? Are they actively stopping people from getting their work done? If they're standing in the lobby just filming, hard to argue that that's really stopping any business from being done. If they're standing in the special ed director's office filming their desk, you can make a pretty good argument that that's actually interrupting their work. So those that stay calm, treat them respectfully. When the person declines to give their name or state their business, you ask a second time. If they decline again, you don't ask a third and a sixth and a tenth time, and they're not going to tell you. The flip side for those that have not gone well is somebody gets angry. They try to get you escalated, and you say something in the heat of the moment that doesn't look good, or you make even a face, you know, a face showing frustration or anger, which they'll immediately then post and say, you know, look, this assistant superintendent came out, or the receptionist approached me. Look how aggressively they approached me. And I think of one where, again, it was during a non-school event, and a district employee approached somebody who was doing this filming, and it got edited to make it look like it was a very aggressive approach. So even just standing still You know, it's very effective in my mind. You stand still, hands in pockets or behind you, so there can be no indication that you're trying to knock the camera away. You're holding it up in front of your face. Yet you can do that while you're standing in front of the entryway to make it a little harder for them to just walk through.
The important things that you mentioned is informing, and we're terrible at this in school districts, and especially the communications people, is of informing our front office support, our secretaries, our executive assistants, of keeping them in the loop of these things. So A, just telling them, like, this is a trend, this may happen, and here's, will alleviate 50% of the emotion. Because you're right, the more emotion, the more reaction, the more views, and the more they love it. So there is an absolute conscious effort to get emotion reaction. So they're teetering as much as they can. That's probably why the hands in the pocket, to make you a little nervous, to call the cops. They probably love the cops, because the cops coming in make for more views. It makes a bigger circus. So that's what helps. But to your point, the more you are just calm, I'm also wondering if you could almost have removed the secretary and you have somebody designated who knows how to deal with this, or will be with you. This person's coming out of a meeting. They'll be with you shortly. We'll get to you, but have somebody almost designated who knows how to deal with that, that's familiar with this, that will do it. So I think that might be a good option, just so the secretary who didn't sign up to deal with this doesn't have to deal with it. And then I'm also wondering, because they do edit some of these to sensationalize them, put the emotion together so they don't have to watch 5 minutes of somebody standing there, could you also, would a strategy be to record them so you have the whole context of the interaction? So when they say, this is how aggressive it was, and they show those three clips, you know, that was over a 3 hour span, it was like, no, here's the full 3 hours and here's the actual interaction, and you can see. So I think recording them, why not record them to have the context and, you know, let people know, here's the transparent interaction that happened over this, however long it was.
Yeah, I think that is a strategy where you can record the person who's recording you. And if they claim they're violating their policy or their privacy in any way, you simply point out that they've already established that there's no expectation of privacy. They're already filming. And then they'll film you filming them, and they'll try to make a big deal about that. And look, they wouldn't even let me do this. But if I had no policy and I had no plan in place, and one of these folks showed up at my district office, my inclination would be, having seen what works and doesn't work, is to do just what you said, Ryan, which is to have somebody come out who is probably a little bit further up the food chain, has a little more responsibility. And I might actually consider just offering to the person, well, if I'm happy to walk you through, give you a tour of the district office, I'm going to record while we're doing this, as you're recording as well, then I'll have my own record. So you're being upfront about that. You say it very calmly. You walk them through, and when they want to go into the special ed director's office, you tell them, well, we can't allow you in that office because there is confidential private information that is out. And you very politely, you know, stand in front of the door. And then if they try to push past you, if they make contact with you, if they raise their voice and start yelling, now they're causing a disruption, and now you may have a basis to actually call the police. And it's very hard to stay calm when the person is doing nothing but trying to get under your skin.
I saw one example of these, and I wish I could remember the district, but the superintendent came out, and, you know, I think that the factors broke in their favor. Maybe he had a few extra minutes on his hand, but it was really the kill him with kindness model. And not only did he, you know, be kind and accommodating, but use it as an opportunity to really talk about the district's message points. Here are the ways that we're serving kids, and here are the accolades that we've won. And, you know, we're serving, you know, kids from underserved communities in this way. And, you know, by spending that time, really won the person over. And it was remarkable to see. And to me, that kind of reinforces the notion of, maybe even though they come in and sometimes look like, you know, menacing members of the public or somebody who might be a threat, but almost treating them like you would treat a member of the media and affording them that courtesy, because this is something that's going to live online, you know, this 20-minute to an hour segment forever. And in this case, that superintendent used it as an opportunity to really, boost his district.
Yeah, and I think that is an amazing approach to do it. But in the moment, It is hard not to get emotional. It's hard not to get upset because you're kind of thinking you might be at risk. They do look kind of dangerous. They're there to kind of prod you a little bit. And then you have, you have staff behind you you're trying to protect. You may have students in the building. So I think just the knowledge of this could happen, having the signage in place, and what Harold said, I think is genius too, is not only the signage, but a policy backing up the signage. Like we do have markers of public versus private space, and this is what they are. So it's like we have these policies, we have these signs. But it is so hard. I watch those videos and you say, oh, I would do this, I would do that. But until you're in that situation, until someone is invading your space, because that's it does feel like an invasion of space, invasion of privacy. It is hard to stay that cool and calm. But I think the awareness is half the battle because they get people because they don't know like what is happening right now. And then you get your emotions are like, oh, I'm not dealing with this. So I think that is a great way to approach it, but it is difficult, especially if you're unaware of what's happening.
Yeah, and the other thing to, to tie back to what we were saying earlier is also giving thought to that sometimes these people may not have good intentions beyond just making money. And so actually, do you have an escape plan? Do you have a back door that people can get out? And a lot of districts are looking at putting up barriers, whether they, building an interior wall that has a door that you have to be admitted into, or even just a little physical, gate that you kind of open to go through. Giving thought to things that both signal this is now you're entering a non-public area, you have to be escorted. And sometimes we'll include in the signage, escort required beyond this location or words to that effect. But then you also have to be thinking about, okay, you put up a little plexiglass gate. What's going to happen if somebody comes in who actually has ill intentions, who is violent, who is unstable, a parent who's angry? And we've worked with districts. I've worked with districts where parents come in angry and they just barge in. I want to see the superintendent. They just walk straight into the superintendent's office. I've also had a city council member do that before, where they were just demanding to see the superintendent immediately and just pushed past everybody. And fortunately, the superintendent's office had a back door. So somebody quickly buzzed the superintendent and said, get out into the parking lot. I'll tell you why in a minute. Take your cell phone. And so they sort of had a plan. But it to me, it's a more holistic approach of how do you deal not just with the disruptions, but how do you deal with the threats? How do you fortify entrances? How do you think about back exits? And again, we're thinking about that with schools all over the place, having one-way locking doors that, you can lock from the interior, and fortifying doors and all of these other things we do. And I would submit that if somebody's really mad, you have no protection essentially at a district office. And I don't say that to scare people. I just want people thinking about what is your game plan. And I always tell this story, which is not directly related to schools, but it's why I'm so conscious of this, which is I clerked for the Texas Supreme Court for a year. So I was in a state that is pretty liberal about open carry and concealed weapons and all these other things. And the Supreme Court building the year that I was there was closed to have asbestos removed. So they had just built a brand new attorney general's office and they put the Supreme Court in the attorney general's office. Great. Problem is, there was no security on that building whatsoever. And so, as a clerk for the court, one of my jobs was about once a month, I got to be the one that stood up in court and said, Oyez, oyez, all rise for the Honorable Supreme Court of Texas. It was very exciting. I was the one who didn't have a Texas accent, so I stood out. And there was a little desk that folks checked into the room, and there were no bailiffs, there was no metal detector, and folks are walking in with cowboy hats and their big Stetsons on. And one day I asked the question, so is there a if there's a security incident, what are we supposed to do? They said, oh, that's a great question. Your job, Harold, is to stand up from the little desk, walk up to the judges, and calmly tell them to follow you out the door and into a back room where there was a large closet. And you're to gather them in the closet and lock the door. Tell them to lock the door. And I said, do I go in the closet with them? They said, no, you then leave, walk back past whatever the threat is, go out into the lobby and see if you can find a uniformed officer, because there's often one down in the main lobby. And what I told them is, if something happens, the first one in that closet is me. I'm getting out of Dodge. But ever after that, I watched during these, you know, very public events of Supreme Court oral arguments, just people milling in and out and no security whatsoever in place. And ever since then, I've had that set in my mind. You always have to have an escape route better than lock the state Supreme Court in a closet. There has to be something better than that.
Did you tell them by the time we get to the closet, it's probably going to be too late in the first place? Like that the walking up calmly to the judges when somebody's in there with whatever is, I don't think we're even going to make it to the closet.
Yeah, it was not a good plan, but I submit that the Texas Supreme Court, they probably have more safety standards now, but I submit that my Texas Supreme Court example applies to every administrative office, every maintenance yard, you know, everywhere you can think of. You know, we have to think about these issues differently in the society we live in now. There's a lot of physical violence. There's a lot of threats. It's a lot of unrest. And so the other half of the formula of thinking about what do we do with these First Amendment auditors, the good news is I've never seen a First Amendment auditor pull a gun. I've never seen them get into a serious physical confrontation. They're unlikely to do that. But you have to wait to find out if that's what they are or if they're something else, if they are an angry parent, if they are a taxpayer's upset or a former employee who's, you know, been released, who's upset. I think of a situation we had years ago where a district employee was released because they happened to have a large amount of armaments in their desk in their office at a school site. So that's not good, right? And so the district said, okay, we're going to terminate this person. They, you know, put them on leave effective immediately. The police were contacted. Person was arrested. They, of course, were let out on bail almost immediately. And one of the first things we in the school district started talking about is, okay, we know we have somebody who likes weapons and has a lot of them, who is now unhappy with you and who is out on bail. And so the district started fortifying the district office and having police patrols and keeping the front door locked. We actually did the same for my law office. We kept the door locked and you had to basically get buzzed in for a while. So it's one of those things where you think about it after it happens, but we have to be thinking about it before it happens. And you don't want to do it in such an unwelcoming way that the perfectly well-meaning parent who's there to sign up their kid for school, you know, shows up and they're frisked and there's a metal detector. And but again, just the extra plan of how do we get out, making sure there's a working phone everywhere, seeing if there is a panic button option, you know, where somebody can buzz in if they need help from somebody more senior, are all things we can think about that don't make it unwelcoming for those who are there for the best of purposes.
Yeah. Having lived in an open carry state for a couple of years and coming from a state from California where obviously you can't, that was a shocking cultural experience for me. Going into a Chipotle, I'll never forget it. And there was a sign that said no firearms allowed inside. And I'm like, that's an option in some other Chipotles in town or some other restaurants. Like, wait a second. Yeah, there's no helmets on motorcycles and you can bring the gun wherever you want. And I was like, wow, I am not used to this. It was different. Harold, my other question is talking about the security and the buzzers and the, is there really any way for any school district, any government agency, movie theater, grocery store to prevent a violent attack if somebody's hell-bent on causing harm? I mean, we spend so much money, and I get it. We do it too. Cameras, fences, this, locks, that. But is there really anything that is, and sometimes parents, I feel like they want to know their kid is 100% safe. Can anyone ever say that is true or possible?
Well, I would like to say that if we passed the right policies and made the right changes societally, that maybe the answer could be potentially yes. But since we can't just wave a magic wand and fix all of that at once, and the fixes aren't obvious all the time, it really is a matter of being prepared for it. It's the earthquake or the fire example. You can be as prepared as you want, but it's going to happen at some point somewhere. And then the question is, do you have an organized plan to get out? And I took a really interesting training through my house of worship where they were training a number of us for services to kind of be extra eyes to help with security in what you do. And it was fascinating. It was taught by a former FBI and actually Secret Service agent. And he now does this training. And he showed videos of what people did in particular incidents where there was a shooting or there was a stabbing or whatever was happening in that moment. And the number of bad decisions that people made, actual real surveillance video that showed people making bad decisions. So one of them I will always remember is that there was an active shooter incident. I think it was in a store or a nightclub. I can't remember exactly. But there were two employees that were in a back room. And they huddled down together each other and kind of went into a hiding mode. And the purpose of the video is they were immediately next to an exit door that would have let them go outside. And in that moment, they hunkered down and they did not go outside. I saw another one, and this is depressing to even talk about, but the Las Vegas shooter who was up in the casino building, you know, shooting down at the crowd at a concert. There was a video that was also shown as part of this training program where there was a boyfriend and girlfriend or husband and wife, and everybody's huddled down, and somebody, one of them had their phone on. And so it was recording everything that was happening, and they were having a debate. Do we hunker down here or do we try to run for it? And the entirety of the shooting was the two of them arguing, do we hunker down or do we run for it? And so having a plan, and again, my experience with the court that year where I had to be an extra set of eyes for security, when I'm in buildings, public buildings, I'm looking where the exits are. I walk into a room, I do a check where the exits are. It's like an Old West movie, right? I tried to sit with my back against a wall so I can see where people are coming in and they're coming out. I take note whether doors are glass or they're wood. You know, is that something that can be barricaded even? And my mind goes in. I don't know if in an actual incident I would be that rational and calm, but I've been trained now a few times on this to spot it. It's, again, what we don't always do for employees, for students. We're starting to do it more.
And again, it's sometimes so hard to tell between, you know, what is a First Amendment auditor versus what is a threat when you have somebody approaching your campus or your office who's acting very strange. I did want to ask about, you know, something that's less threatening, but staff might not know how to handle it. Do we see PRAs, records requests in real time, you know, the demand to see certain records, and how should staff respond to that?
That's a great question. So, yeah, we do see that. And the Public Records Act is a really interesting law. It's extremely broad. It's protected by a constitutional right under an initiative that was passed in the state. We love our initiatives that rose it to the same level of you have a right to public records the same way you have a right to escape the death penalty if you're innocent. I mean, it rises to this constitutional level of protection. And the Public Records Act says right in it that all records, all public records are available for public inspection during regular business hours. But the Public Records Act also says in it that you can assess whether something needs to be redacted, whether it could be withheld because it's student information, particular other kinds of information like attorney-client privileged information, for example, and that you have 10 days to respond to somebody to say whether you're going to produce it. Well, how do you square a law that says everything's immediately available with a law that says you can respond within 10 days? And I always use this illustration, and I know Ryan's heard this one from me, but I like this one because it just drives it home. It kind of depends whether you can legitimately argue that there may be something protected there or not. So in the case of one city, this is an actual case that went to trial. Somebody walked into the planning office and went up to the clerk's desk and said, I'd like to see all the permits that have been pulled for new development or new construction in the last 6 months. And the clerk told them, well, you'll have to put your request in writing and, you know, we'll respond within 10 days and we'll get back to you. So the person took the piece of paper to fill out and left the office, but they didn't go very far. They were right outside the office and they watched as a developer walked in who does a lot of work with the city. And literally just walked up to the clerk and said, hey, do you have the binder of all the permits? And the clerk reached under the desk, it was right there the whole time, pulled it out and handed it to the developer. So the person who did not get that treatment sued the city and won. And the court ordered the city to pay their attorney's fees and compelled the city, when you have information that's immediately available, you can't give it to some and not others. And so what one school district does I work with, which I think is very clever, is they've picked all the low-hanging fruit where there's no question it's a public record. It's your board packet, you know, the public board packet. It's really basic and public information that's readily available. And they keep it up front in the lobby. And if somebody asks for it, they reach under the desk and they pull it out and they let the person inspect it. If they want to make copies, they're allowed to make copies, you know, at a low cost. But then if they ask, I want to see all correspondence between the board members from the last 24 months, including all text messages, you don't have that readily handy. It's all going to have to be reviewed for privilege. There's going to be discussions of confidential matters. There's going to be information that's on those devices that have nothing to do with school business. They're personal messages that are going to have to be excluded. So what I always say is it's a rule of reason. You have to be able to, can I put you on a stand? If you're my client, can I put you on the stand at trial? And can you raise your right hand and with a straight face convince a judge that, yes, this information was not readily available for these reasons? That poor city clerk in the illustration I gave you, they had no explanation other than they knew the developer and they didn't know this person. So they did a favor for the developer. Doesn't work that way.
So if you could reasonably make that case and they don't want this information sent to them, they want to see it, you could say, okay, come back in 10 days and we'll provide those records for you.
Yeah, or we will respond to you, you know, give us your contact information, we'll respond to you and give you a date and time that you can see records if you don't want to make copies. And then the next thing the school district has to think about is one of the reasons that literally you can't make all records immediately available. How do you know the person's not going to rip it up or run out the door with it or start writing all over it? So you then have the opportunity to actually make copies. So when the person comes in, even if they didn't request copies, they're not looking at the originals.
That sounds very reasonable.
Yeah, and it's a good point, though, because we kind of default to like, here's the process, we'll get back to you in 10 days. But if it's easy, they have the right, especially if they're filming or trying to make a big deal, and you're going to get it to them anyway, just get it to them. Who cares? Like, just avoid the conflict. It's not a big deal. If it's a board packet or something easy, what's your policy? It's not going to change. It's been like this for 30 years. Just give it to them and avoid the emotion, avoid the conflict, and try to acquiesce with that. I'm curious in the lawsuit with the city. So when they said they sue, and the hard part is, like, I don't think that city clerk had bad intent. It was what you said. It was the relationship. She knew the developer. Rich probably came in every Wednesday and looking for this. And so it was just, she knew him and had that relationship. So I don't think, you know, there was malintent there, but it's a good point. Like, why does he get the binder and I don't? Like, that's not what the law says. So when this person sued the city, you mentioned the legal fees they get paid. Like, what are they suing for and what are they entitled to get?
Yeah, so they're suing for violation of the Public Records Act, and they're suing to compel the public agency to perform differently in the future. So sometimes the Public Records Act lawsuit is, give me the records because you haven't turned them over yet. In that case, I think after they got caught, they turned the records over. But then it's a matter of seeking an order to compel the city in the future not to repeat the violation. And then the attorney's fees are the plaintiff in a successful Public Records Act lawsuit, almost without exception, is going to recover the entirety of the fees that they incurred in litigating these things. And, you know, we, for the fun of it, years ago, and this is now outdated, we sat down, we thought about what would it cost to litigate a matter if you just looked at the absolute minimum that had to happen. You have to show up to court for a case management conference. You have to, you know, there's, in this hypothetical, there's no discovery. It's just, you do the absolute minimum necessary. And this was probably 10, 15 years ago. We were already saying $50,000 or $60,000 just for the basic court appearances and the most minimal pieces. So when these cases are litigated, they go into the six figures very quickly. I think of one that we actually had a hard fought case on the Public Records Act where we won on the bulk of the suit was over documents we withheld, where the requesting party felt that there should have been some of the things that we felt were privileged they didn't. And we prevailed on 98% of the documents. And on a smattering of the documents, the judge decided, well, I think you can make a colorable argument. This is public. And then we were forced to pay attorney's fees, even though we won the bulk of the case. Fortunately, the judge reduced the attorney's fees to reflect that. But, we're kind of hitting a theme, right? Show a record that you've been reasonable, you've been accommodating, you've been polite, you're treating everybody equally. I use that as an example a lot. Somebody shows up to the district office and says, I want to see the superintendent. And they're told, well, here's a number for their assistant. You can call, you can make an appointment. But then the president of the PTA walks in and says, hey, I want to see the superintendent. And they're escorted immediately into the office. That's the developer with the, you know, the public records at the clerk's office. And in fact, there's one case that is actually a published appellate court case that was really interesting. It was about a bid protest. And what happened in that case was that the school district put something out to bid. There was an issue with the bid that was submitted by the low bidder where they made a mistake. They made a significant mistake. It was about an $800,000 mistake they made in their bid. And they wanted to withdraw the bid. And so they said, gosh, we want to withdraw the bid. And the response from the district was basically, oh, sure, submit the paperwork. They submitted the paperwork wrong. And the district didn't tell them they submitted the paperwork wrong. And it was this whole to-do. And the thing that's ironic about it, there's a couple of cases where this happened. It turned out that while the district isn't telling them what's going on and isn't producing materials to them, they're producing it to the second low bidder and the third low bidder who want to do that work. And maybe the district has a long-standing relationship with. Well, you can imagine how that ends up in court. One of those cases, I always remember, they actually started quoting Hamlet in the judge's opinion about something was rotten, you know, there at the district office. And so this reasonableness, fairness, staying calm, treating everybody equally, whether you're talking about Public Records Act, First Amendment auditors, all these different pieces, it's a unified theme of what you want to try to do to minimize your exposure.
I may or may not have worked for that district at that time. I remember that. That ruling.
Speaking of reasonable and fair, though, so here's the problem that us working for the public entity faced, and the frustration that comes with dealing with PRAs is that some people will take advantage of it and try just for the malice of making your life miserable. Whether it's an angry parent that is going to send you 50 PRAs and bury you for years, or the marketing agency that wants all your staff's email addresses so they can spam them and they're trying to profit off of things that are not of the public interest, that's of your private interest and your wallet and your income. So I think that's the frustration and where the rub has come over the years. It's where it's like, you're clearly taking advantage of this law. So then the public agency will say, well, I'm going to, instead of giving you this binder right now, submit it via paper. I'll get back to you in 10 days, but I could give you this binder, but you're abusing the system. So I feel like there does need to be, and I know the problem, I don't know the solution, but people have taken advantage of this law. Like, I get the intent. I think it's good transparency. Publicly funded entities should be transparent and public with the funding. But when people find the loophole, that's where the frustration on the public agency comes in. It's like, come on, we're here supporting kids and staff, not being buried in paperwork because you want every email that was sent from, you know, Mr. Smith to Mrs. Smith from 1982 to 2024. Like, come on, man. So is there any legislation or thoughts at the higher levels where let's make this more reasonable and fair for both sides, you know, to that level?
Yeah, I have no good news for you on that front, because when the legislatures most recently looked at this, they actually started trying to implement even greater obligations of the public agency to turn things over. So there was legislation proposed that started talking about, you know, having to turn things around even faster. And right now under the law, you can within 10 days say it's going to take us 30 more days to produce this to you. That law would have limited your ability to push it out much further. Fortunately, it didn't get implemented. But when the legislature looks at this, they only look in one direction. which is make things more publicly available. And there are some old cases from like the 1970s that talk about there's a certain point where a request becomes unreasonable. And you just can say no because it's such a burden. But you go back and you look at those cases, the big burden is you would have had to produce 6,000 pages of documents. Well, in 1970, that's a lot of documents. In 2024, it's a sneeze. It's nothing because, you know, I can generate a million documents by going onto my computer as soon as we're off and running the right search. And so, you know, again, it's a rule of reasonableness that applies. And there's no question that some Public Records Act requests are weaponized. They're just there to delay and vex and annoy. And you've got to take them really carefully. You have to take them one at a time. You have to think about if there's a way out. We have a lot of clients, for example, on the marketers who've pushed back and basically said, look, as far as we can tell, you're only doing this to send spam emails to our teachers. There is a vital public interest in teachers being able to get through their emails in a timely fashion, respond to parents, deal with schoolwork, and we're not going to let you spam them. And so we've done a weighing, and the Public Records Act says if the public's interest in disclosure is clearly outweighed, it's got to be clearly outweighed, it's a high standard, by the public interest in non-disclosure, then you're allowed not to disclose. But in those cases, we don't just say no. First, we try to work with the requesting party. If they won't work with us, then we go research them a little bit and try to figure out, is this a marketing entity? If we find out it's a marketing entity, the letter they get from us has an actual explanation of why the public's interest in non-disclosure is clearly greater. So there are ways to say no, but you've got to do it. You've got to equip yourself pretty well to do it.
Harold, this has just been so unbelievably helpful. I think that you know, for everybody who's listening to this podcast, the first thing that they should do is schedule a meeting with your frontline staff, all of those who are working in the offices, to help come up with a plan and to prepare them with tips and strategies. So do you have any resources? Are there any links, places to go that can help all of us prepare our frontline teams?
You know, one of the things that you can do is almost every school district has a board policy and sometimes administrative regulation number 1250. And that is generally talking about visitors to campuses. Some school districts, and we've worked with a number of them, have started beefing up that model to go beyond that and talk about visitors to district offices, signage, who has the right to decide what's a public area and what's not. Two school districts that we worked with, that this is on their websites, it's all public, so I can share it. Dublin Unified School District and Los Gatos Saratoga Union High School District have fairly similar language. We worked with both of them to beef up that board policy and administrative regulation. That's a good starting point. And I'd say another starting point is talk to the districts around you. Find out what others have done. The best, you know, form of flattery is imitation, right? So contact them and find out if you've got another district that's had safety training or that redid their district office to address these issues. Find out from them what it is that they did. You know, share the information with one another. And I think there's a lot of good resources out there just on school safety that we read and we look at and we think about it as K-12 school safety, or now say TK-12 school safety. But you can look at that and start thinking, well, is some of this, are these things that we can lift over to protect our employees in administrative spaces? And I think there's a lot of good information. We're applying only to the school site and not to the district office.
Harold Freeman, Lozano Smith, this has been very informative, a little depressing, but I think very helpful for our audience, our colleagues, and everyone in education. I really appreciate the time. And is there any, if we want to get in touch with you, and I'm glad we finally got to connect, because Lozano and Smith, you guys have done a lot of work, and I know you guys have a podcast. If people want to learn more about you guys, get involved, what's the best way to do that?
Folks are welcome to visit our website, which is lozanosmith.com. It's LOZANOsmith.com. We will be doing a podcast on this very topic. I'm not sure when, so watch for that. And then the other thing that a lot of our clients have fun with is we actually have an app, the LS app. You can look us up in the App Store under Lozano Smith, And all of our client news briefs and all of our podcasts can be found there. So we have a lot of clients who actually say that they listen to our podcasts as they drive to and from work. And it's a lot of good information on cutting edge issues.
Harold, I don't know how you do it. This work is very difficult. You're dealing with the negatives so much, and everyone calls you during a crisis. The desk behind you, which most people can't see, has more stacks of paper than it looks like you are submitting a public records request, and you got 1,000 documents there. But you do it with a smile, and you have a positive energy, and it seems like you love your work, which we greatly appreciate.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right, that's it for this edition of the School PR Podcast. Thank you, Ian, for co-hosting. Harold, for being here. It's terrific information. Thank you for listening. Check out the School PR Podcast on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, all that fun stuff. And we will see you next time on the School PR Podcast.